Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Donald Trump's executive order banning travelers from six Muslim-majority countries goes into effect tomorrow. Once again, the order already faces legal challenges. So far, eight states, including California, Hawaii, and Maryland, have filed a lawsuit against the ban. The ban and ongoing deportations of mostly Mexicans and South Americans have caused millions of undocumented immigrants to live in fear of being arrested, detained, and deported. Since the election, the number of hate crimes targeting Muslims and Jewish community centers and cemeteries have been on the rise. And then last month, at a bar in Olathe, Kansas, Adam Purinton, a white man, shot two Indian men who he thought were from Iran. One man died. Witnesses say Purinton yelled, "Get out of my country." So why is this happening in a country that has traditionally been referred to as a melting pot, welcoming people from different countries, races, and religions? Does the history of the United States support this claim? Well, the new documentary, The Chinese Exclusion Act, meticulously details decades of anti-immigrant rhetoric and violence targeted at Chinese immigrants. In the 19th century, anti-Chinese sentiment resulted in the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. It was the country's first law that banned immigration by race or nationality. The law barred Chinese laborers from entering the country and prohibited Chinese immigrants from seeking American citizenship. The film asks a lot of the same questions that we are asking today in 2017. Who gets to be an American? How do we define citizenship? When and why should anyone be blocked from coming to the United States or deported? Where does anti-immigrant hysteria come from? Rick Burns is a six-time Emmy Award-winning director who has been creating historical documentaries for public television for over 20 years. And Li Xin Yu is an award-winning film editor and a longtime collaborator of Rick Burns. Rick Burns and Li Xin Yu are co-directors of the Chinese Exclusion Act. The film is incredible, and it will have its West Coast premiere at the annual CamFest on Sunday at 7 o'clock at the Castro Theater in San Francisco, and you can watch the trailer at yourcallradio.org. Rick Burns and Li Xin Yu join us from the studios of the Radio Foundation in New York. Hi, Rick, and hi, Li Xin. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Hi, Rose. Thanks for having us.
Well, great to be with you.
It's great to have both of you, and congratulations on this film. Thank you so much for making it. You know, I am a California native, and I didn't really know much about the Chinese Exclusion Act. Li Xin, did you know much about it before you embarked on this journey?
You know, actually not. I'm sort of ashamed to say. Rick and I were working on a film called Way West back in the early 90s. And towards the end of the project, we came across an incident that took place on the Snake River, where a group of Chinese miners, about 31, 34 of them, had been attacked by a band of horse traders and were slaughtered, mutilated, body parts thrown into the river, and it just floated upstream and was discovered. And we just sort of was shocked that, A, of this particular violence, and then B, why it was happening and sort of the whole history surrounding it. And so that began a decades-long sort of thinking about this issue and learning more about it. And I think we were always wanting to place this history in the larger context of American history, sort of understanding all the forces, you know, economic, social, political, geographical, all everything that kind of led to the passage of this act, which is, you know, any American, if you ask them about this, will be really surprised.
Yeah, shocked. And shocked, actually.
Shocked, yeah, yes.
Yeah. Rick, what about you? Did you know much about this act?
Well, like Li Xin, we learned about the Snake River Massacre. You know, Snake River forms the border of Idaho and Oregon, 20, 25 odd years ago. And more recently, about 5 years ago, Louise Mira, who's the president of the New York Historical Society, had a wonderful idea to do an exhibit at the New York Historical Society on the Chinese Exclusion Act and asked us to join forces with her. That exhibit opened 2.5 years ago. And we launched into that, this project, therefore, in 2012, sort of with a deep sense of uneasiness about the background of violence in the 19th century and also, kind of a sharpened sense of this act, May 6th, 1882, President Chester A. Arthur signs into law a unique piece of federal legislation, unique at the time, but the first of many, which barred Chinese laborers from coming to the country and barred Chinese full stop from becoming citizens of the United States. And it didn't matter whether you were a citizen from, Shanghai or Beijing, or you were a Chinese national coming from London. The fact of the matter was, is if you were racially Chinese, you were considered incapable of assimilating to the American experiment, biologically, culturally, racially unfit to be part of the American dream, likely to be an enormous burden, racial and otherwise, to the American project, and therefore needed to be exempt, preempted to avoid further social issues of the kind, for example, the United States was right in the middle of and had gone through hideously with the Civil War and issues of race and slavery and African-American status. So we really wanted to sort of drill down on this and go, where did this come from? And as importantly, why don't we remember it? Mm. 1882 is the threshold of what was called the new immigration. 24, 25 million people coming into America in a generation and a half at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century. So at that point, a population which at that point represented 0.2% of the population, 105,000 people, were being preemptively excluded. And even those who were in the country while they were grandfathered in were sort of excluded, and marginalized within American society. How did that happen? When did we decide who was an American, who wasn't an American? And in the course of that investigation, discovered that this story of the Chinese Exclusion Act is not a story just about Chinese and Chinese immigrants, not just a story about immigrants, but a story about America itself from before the beginning right down to today. So surprise, surprise, tomorrow the Muslim ban goes into effect.
Yeah. Well, and that's what I wanted to ask both of you about. Li Shen, the history in this film is so strikingly similar to what we are facing today. And as Rick said, the ban banning travelers from 6 Muslim-majority countries goes into effect tomorrow. And then I just can't stop thinking about what happened last month at that bar in Olathe, Kansas, where a white man shot 2 Indian men who he thought were from Iran. And witnesses say that he yelled, "Get out of my country." And now there are a lot of stories, and The New Yorker has a story about how Indians are living in fear right now, wondering what's to come. So you spent so long on this film. You interviewed historians, and I mean, this became such a part of your life. And now we have this. How are you making sense of this? Well, what's going through your mind right now?
Well, it just feels like history is repeating itself. All of this was going on back, and I think, as Rick is saying, from the very get-go, I think we as Americans never really came to term with the fact that from the very beginning, we were a nation of color. There were slaves who were brought here. There were the Native Americans who were here. There were the Mexican Americans who were across the West. And we simply just, the manifest destiny idea that the Anglo-American will just rightfully overtake. And then subsequently along the way, just categorize everyone else as others. Mm. And when you put people as others, it becomes very easy to say, well, X, Y, and Z, you're just not part of us. And so just over time, over and over again, let's figure out a way to get rid of them.
I think there's a kind of, Rose, a constitutive ambivalence and contradiction in the American experience, that we are indeed made up, we are a nation of immigrants, but we have all been a nation of immigrants that from the very beginning was profoundly ambivalent about that. And so we are sort of a nation that's not only a nation of immigrants, but a nation of a kind of a frightened, proactive identity creation mechanism, which wants to decide that some Americans are more American than others and some Americans are less American than others. And it has to do with identity. It has to do with class. It certainly has to do with race. And that runs, as our wonderful, one of our many, many wonderful historians, Erica Lee, as points out in the film, I think very, very eloquently. You know, this ambivalence about immigration runs right through American history from the beginning. And that when you come down to today and you think, like, why is it that we feel that we're a nation of immigrants and that we sort of make the presumption that we've always been so? It's a very, very recent phenomenon. It's a phenomenon of the last 50, 60, 70 years. Before JFK, John F. Kennedy, when then Senator Kennedy wrote a book called The Nation of Immigrants in the 1950s. We are a nation extraordinarily ambivalent about immigrants. We have been ambivalent about those 24, 25 million people coming from Europe and Southern Europe and Eastern Europe in the late 19th and early 20th century. I mean, a watchword of the time was Europe is vomiting. And so it was really, as Erica Lee points out, it was a Cold War phenomenon after the Second World War and a civil rights phenomenon when it now seemed advantageous as well as morally just to say to the rest of the world on whom we were projecting an image of ourselves as democratic and in a kind of a scrimmage with alternate views of societies, particularly the Soviet Union and Chinese communism, that we were open, that we were egalitarian. And sure enough, the Chinese Exclusion Act, while technically repealed in 1943, really as a public relations gesture during the Second World War, didn't in fact come to an end until 1965, when the Hart-Celler Act, a landmark piece of legislation, eradicated the national origins system, which had been in effect modeled on the Chinese Exclusion Act since 1924. So I, born in 1955, was one of those people who came up, as was Li Xin, also born in 1955, with the presumption that the Statue of Liberty's torch, sort of warmly glowing over New York Harbor, had always been there. Of course, it was put up at the very moment in the 1980s that the Chinese Exclusion Act went into effect, and that we were always constitutionally in our cultural and political DNA open to immigrants. Not so. We have always been ambivalent, and it's really a very modern phenomenon that we have decided that we are, on principle, a nation that's always been open to immigrants, even since we announced that in the 1960s, and have more or less cleaved to that ideologically ever since. Underneath the surface, and sometimes not just underneath the surface, erupting into the contemporary moment, is this profound sense that some people have more right to be American than other people.
Li Xin, I often say that we're a nation of immigrants founded on native genocide, because when you say sometimes when you say we're a nation of immigrants, Native Americans are kind of forgotten in that sentence.
Right.
And so in some ways, I wasn't surprised that I didn't know much about the Chinese Exclusion Act, because I wasn't taught much about native genocide in school. So what do you think it means, really, to come to terms with our history?
I think it's, you know, if we don't understand our past, it's really hard to move forward mm-hmm. to making decisions of what we want our future to be. And, you know, when you categorize certain people into this otherness, there's extreme ambiguity for those people. And it's extremely difficult to live under ambiguity. And we know from our history as well that immigration is it's kind of the foundation. You know, the founding fathers knew that we needed to have immigrants to come and settle the nation and cultivate and build up this poor, you know, run down, bankrupt country at the time, a young republic. And so from the very beginning, and throughout the ages, immigrants who come, they are in fact a very courageous group of people for reasons, you know, they're leaving their home country, they're leaving their family, they're leaving a known world to them to come to a brand new world forging ahead, you know, usually under very difficult circumstances, and make a life for themselves. And that kind of energy has been just enormous in building this nation. And so we just kind of tend to forget that and continue to struggle with, you know, are we a pluralistic society or do we want to be homogeneous and, you know, and it's an evolving struggle that continues and we have to just always kind of stay on top of it and not
Not forget.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. Not forget. You know, remember the history because the history is so illuminating, and not forget.
Lee Hsien Yu is an award-winning film director, and Rick Burns is a six-time Emmy award-winning director, and they are co-directors of the new documentary, The Chinese Exclusion Act. The film will have its West Coast premiere at the annual ChemFest on Sunday at 7 o'clock at the Castro Theater in San Francisco. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. Are you familiar with the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act? It's a landmark, little-known piece of federal legislation that really reshaped American law, civic life, foreign policy. It's the only federal legislation in U.S. history ever to single out and name a specific race and nationality for exclusion from immigration and citizenship. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What questions do you have for Rick and Lee Hsien about what they discovered? It's an incredible documentary with so much amazing history about California and San Francisco, but really about the whole country. But I loved the parts about California and San Francisco. It just revealed so much information that I never learned in school. If you are of Chinese heritage, have your parents shared their stories with you? Do you know about your ancestors, the circumstances involved in their decision to come to the United States? Do you know how they were treated once they got here? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Well, let's dive in and talk about this amazing history that you tell in this documentary. It started really with trade in China, and in the film, you talk about the fact that China was one of the few countries that could do international trade that was not yet colonized. The U.S. was very interested in trading with China. Rick, talk a little bit about some of the more interesting aspects that you uncovered about that relationship.
You know, it is fascinating, and I think it speaks to something which is a theme throughout the film and, of course, a theme throughout American and world history from the late 18th century down to today, which is that, you know, we think of America as a place, you know, manifest destiny, the exceptionalist idea of America, which tends to lead towards exclusion, national exclusion. But, of course, the country is founded out of a global movement of people and things, you know, that goes back to the Renaissance, 1492, Columbus. What is Columbus? What are Europeans looking for in the 15th, 16th century? They're looking for a faster route to China. They want Chinese and Oriental things, which are extraordinarily sophisticated and of high value, lacquer and incense and silk and tea. And so, you know, there's a way in which it's not just a sort of a lovely conceit to say America was founded as Europeans were trying to get to China and get Chinese things. And then, as Lee Hsien was pointing out, from the very beginning, America, this bankrupt nation of 4 million people that had just released itself from dependence, from inclusion in the British Empire, were excluded. London said, fine, go your own way, but you're sure as hell not going to trade within the British Commonwealth, which by that point had a footprint over much of the world. And what wasn't British colonial power dominated was French or Portuguese or Spanish. So where were they going to look? To the one nation, the one empire that had not yet been colonized by Europeans in the late 18th century. The first ship to leave New York Harbor in 1784 after the end of the American Revolution was called the Empress of China. And she went to China to establish the China trade so that this struggling nation could get off the ground. And, you know, it was profoundly successful. The China trade, we went to China. We began to trade under very, very strict circumstances controlled by the Qing dynasty. And on it went from there. Much of the infrastructure of early America, the canals, later even the railroad system, was paid for by the profits that came in from the China trade, with a huge problem from the beginning, which was that there was a huge imbalance of trade. China wanted nothing, at which point one of the great sort of mechanisms and horrors of 19th century history was put into place. The British and their young now American trading partners decided to give the Chinese something that they wanted, opium. Mm. And when the Chinese got upset about that and burned ships filled with opium after millions of people in South China had been addicted, they burned American and British ships, and the British and the Americans went to war with them in what we now call glibly the Opium Wars. And we bring it up only to say that people don't start moving around the world out of sort of ex nihilo. It doesn't just happen. Chinese didn't just show up at our shore. It happened because there was already a profound movement which was centuries old of people and things around the world, which was accelerated in the 19th century with the forcible opening of China, the Opium Wars, the Taiping Rebellion. And now you had a complicated group of people in South China whose options were limited, who needed to go somewhere, and there were American ships in the harbor, and they jumped on them. And they went to the gold rush after 1848. It was discovered in January. You know, they were part of the earliest groups of 49ers, though not in great numbers at first, the Chinese. But the world rushed in, and the Chinese were part of that world rushing in. And so it shows you at a point where, America was still essentially an East Coast phenomenon in 1849, 1850. It had just acquired by force the American Far West from Mexico. So at this very critical moment when globalization, which has already been moving, picks up and goes on steroids in the mid-19th century, in comes everybody, and now America has a special challenge. Who's American? Is it Sonorans? Is it French? Is it, is it Australians? Is it, God forbid, Chinese who have just started to rush in along with American miners from the East? So you see this, that's why California, which as well as Stegner, great American writer, said, California is just like the rest of the world, only more so. California turns out to be this sort of petri dish on the west coast of the continent of North America in which crucial issues of identity, pluralism, justice. And that's where the crucial part of it really comes in. People from outside the country as well as people from inside the country knew that there was something really special about this place. It wasn't that there were a lot of white people here. It was that it had a constitution, a Bill of Rights. It had the rule of law, and that it was an evolving process and an evolving set of structures. We are a nation of laws, not a nation of men and women. And people from outside the country saw that remarkable thing. And the truth is, America is a global phenomenon from the beginning. That's what it means to be a nation of laws. And it turns out, and this is the shining, rewarding, inspiring part of the story, that as men and women, Chinese in this case, came from abroad, inspired by the attraction of the rule of law and democracy and all men are created equal. Hmm. They were the ones, time and again, who made those words have real meaning as they saw how unique they were and who then used those words, not just the words of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, but of the 14th Amendment signed into law in 1868 that says all persons have a right to be here. All persons born here are Americans. And so there's this tremendous way in which the Chinese immigrants, so hard done by, are in some sense more Americans than the Americans in the land that's excluding them. And that's a hugely interesting and powerful and hopeful story in the way in this kind of huge backwash of forces that includes so much injustice that the basic principles on which the nation is founded are ones which are really in some sense intrinsically colorblind, national blind, and are really there to be grasped on by anyone who sees them. And that's why the story of the Chinese Exclusion Act is not just the story of persecution and exclusion, but the story of forcible self-inclusion using the very principles that are in some sense enshrined in the most basic documents of the Republic. And that's what happened over the course of the 62 years of exclusion and what continues to happen today. And that's why this is a story of enormous heroism and essentially a story of American promise.
Li Xin, it's also so interesting to learn about why Chinese people came to the United States to begin with. And that story tends to be ignored or overlooked when we talk about immigration. And when Rick was talking about the UK turning to opium to regain trade power, Americans were also involved with that, in that. And so many Chinese became addicted to opium, the Chinese said enough. And that was the pretext for Great Britain going to war. And so you had agricultural land in China. It was destroyed, a huge problem with drought, poverty. And so poor people in China had to look for jobs. And then they heard about gold being discovered in the United States. And yeah, those ships were there ready to take people to California for the gold rush.
Right. It's sort of what Rick was saying, this immigration, migration, you know, the courage of these people that I spoke of earlier. The flip side is, you know, how bad things were at home, the push factors. And those factors, you know, it has to do with globalization, right. Has to do with the foreign, you know, for sure the Qing Dynasty was falling apart due to corruption and its own weight. But the foreign forces had a huge influence on sort of making life unsurvivable for the Chinese. And so, and Chinese from the Pearl River Delta area had a tradition of migrating out into Asia, you know, other parts of Asia to look for work, and they would return. That's how trade was not a new thing. So the idea of getting on a ship to go much further, for sure, to across the Pacific to come to this country is even a greater effort.
You brought up a really good point. You know, people, as the wonderful historian May Nye says in our film, people who have options don't leave. People who are doing okay tend not to leave. Right. It's the people whose choices have been reduced to near zero or actually zero who get up and move. That is the actual DNA of international migration. You stay, you know, you don't migrate unless you have to. And so this is a group of people who absolutely had to at that point. And part of the reasons, as Lishan is saying, was because of this complex global set of interactions. And they're on the move as well. And it makes us have to understand, like, we can't simply say, build the wall. And by the way, you know, build the wall. We're going to build a great wall was exactly what was being said from Governor John Bigler's time in the 1850s in California right down through the beginning of the exclusion period in the 1880s. There's Puck illustrations, which are breathtaking, of, you know, a motley group of American workers, some black, some Irish, some German, building a huge stone wall while on the far side of the Pacific, Great Wall of China is disintegrating and hopping into boats are the Yellow Peril horde coming over. You know, it is not the case that people show up at your doorstep for no reason whatsoever, whether they're coming from Latin America, Mexico, the Caribbean, South America, East Europe, or China. And there's a profound way in which I feel America has done disservice to itself, to its own history, and to its moral obligations to the rest of the world not to realize that we are not an exceptional nation. We are not a nation in its own private Idaho, despite the Snake River Massacre. We are a nation that has always been knit in to a global reality of which we are fully – in which we are fully implicated, in which we're fully involved, in which we have moral necessities that are actually transnational.
Rick Burns is an award-winning director, and Lishan Yu is an award-winning film editor, and they are co-directors of the new documentary, The Chinese Exclusion Act. The film will have its West Coast premiere at the annual CamFest on Sunday at 7 o'clock at the Castro Theater in San Francisco, and you can watch a trailer at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. We'll be right back.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org. And you can also tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, World Have Your Say from the BBC. Stay with us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about the new documentary, The Chinese Exclusion Act. It details decades of anti-immigrant rhetoric and violence targeted at Chinese immigrants. In the 19th century, anti-Chinese sentiment resulted in the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, the United States' first law that banned immigration by race or nationality. And today we're joined by Rick Burns and Li Xin Yu. They are co-directors of The Chinese Exclusion Act. This film will have its West Coast premiere at the annual CamFest on Sunday at 7 o'clock at the Castro Theater in San Francisco. I'm guessing this is probably going to sell out, so you might want to get your tickets soon. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Li Xin and Rick, we have full lines. We have a lot of questions for you. So let's kick it off with Dan in San Francisco. Hi, Dan. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Two questions real quick, if I might. I'm wondering what lessons you might take, or and if you looked into the labor movement roots of the Chinese Exclusion Act gaining kind of popular steam in America. And I'm also curious, what legacy you see in Chinese-American culture of the Chinese Exclusion Act, which obviously was in place for quite some time.
Those are two really fantastic questions, Dan. The fascination of this story is how intricately interknit it is with everything that's going on in America, from the mid-19th century on. The Chinese come over. They're in small number for the gold rush. They begin to be excluded already because they're competing in the gold mines or are seen to be competitors in the gold mines with white miners. They're essentially forced out of the gold fields. Then the Civil War comes along. They're finding what jobs they can. That's why they go into laundries. Nobody else wants to do the laundries. That's why they start opening restaurants. But then the Railroad Act is signed into law. The Central Pacific, who are building the Western End, need a labor force comparable to the huge number of largely Irish immigrants who are building the Union Pacific West from Omaha. Who's on the ground in California to build it? Well, there's a reasonable number of Chinese laborers. Very quickly, Charles Crocker, Leland Stanford begin to discover that these Chinese laborers are extremely effective. They're self-organizing. They're relatively healthy. They're self-disciplined in a way that many of the white Chinese miners turned out not to be. So they actively recruit these miners to come in. And in a sense, that moment of proactive recruiting of more Chinese to come in to help with the building of the Transcontinental Railroad is the beginning of a break point. Because now you have Chinese who begin to be seen as and called sort of coolies who come in en masse, who are going to compete with American, real American labor forces at the ground and take their jobs. And the irony is that once they do such a good job finishing the Transcontinental Railroad in 1869, is every one of these dynamics that have to do with labor, now that we have a national transportation system, wham, is nationalized. So now, southern plantation owners in Mississippi and Louisiana are looking for a labor force to replace the emancipated slaves, the freedmen who are flooding off the plantations. Who's going to pick the cotton? They reach out to California to get Chinese to come in and pick the cotton. Labor strikes begin to take place in places like North Adams, Massachusetts, where in 1870 a shoe factory goes on strike. What does the head of the shoe factory do? He looks what's happening in the South with the plantations, and he sends a recruiter out to bring 75 Chinese in from the West Coast. Now, the numbers are always very, very small. But what gets to be seen is this idea that this alien, very, very different, unassimilable mass of people are going to stream in. Look at their numbers. They may only be a few now, but they could bring in millions, are going to come in. They're unassimilable. They're essentially parasitic, almost not human. And they're going to come in and start competing with the people for the low-end jobs in the American economy. So you begin to have this interplay between sort of class tension. You know, the Chinese are then associated with the monopolists, with the fat cats, with the people who are going to steal people's jobs. So then you get to see this tremendous struggle and swirling set of forces which have to do with race, class, national identity. And that's what builds over the 1870s. And as it builds, you begin to see politicians across the country, not just now in California, begin to double down on and pander to this growing and exasperate growing white working class fears of the other, in particular the Chinese. Violence begins to break out. You know, it becomes this sort of like vicious self-confirming cycle in which, you know, the more, and finally it all spills out in the 1880s when the legislation goes into effect. And it's really at that point, you got to remember, the numbers are very small. Any actual economic analysis would show that the Chinese were not taking away jobs which non-Chinese Americans or other immigrants were taking. So that it's really kind of being blown out and blown out of proportion and becoming part of this American dynamic. And of course, once it's consolidated into law in 1882, it then has this extraordinarily terrible impact, which is that it legitimizes the very hatreds and fears which have already been exacerbated through the 1860s and 70s, now become legitimated at the national level. It's okay to exclude Chinese. And now a kind of sort of accelerated movement within the country, especially in the American West, Wyoming, Idaho, Oregon, Washington, California, Utah, where Chinese communities, Chinese mining camps, Chinese farms are purged. 300 cities, villages, and hamlets across the American Far West were purged, and sometimes purged entirely, Eureka, Tacoma, of their Chinese populations. And the amount of violence that took place as a result is huge. So this is a case study that goes from, you know, economics, labor, class, race, psychology, scientific racism. There's no aspect of the components of what a society is that aren't engaged and enlisted and also revealed and illuminated by this story.
And Li-Shin, do you want to take the second part of Dan's question about how this has affected Chinese communities across the country?
Well, just to add to that, you know, this was also all taking place. You know, we have to remember the precedent of the successful removal of huge Native American populations. Mm. You know, so it's every, you know, history doesn't happen in isolation. Everything informs each other, and so we already have learned how to push Native Americans off to tiny plots of land. So it's very easy then now to say, well, you know, the law says the Chinese shouldn't be here, so let's just get rid of them and the violence.
Li-Shin, to that point, yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you know if when the Chinese came to the United States, what kind of contact did they have with Native Americans? Did that come up in any of the interviews?
No, you know, it didn't. It's interesting. I mean, there got to be a growing amount of contact between Native Chinese American and African American. Mm. There were anti-miscegenation laws which prevented Chinese immigrants and Chinese Americans from intermarrying with white Americans. But those laws, as there were with African Americans, those laws, you know, did not prevent, you know, sort of intimacy and family creation amongst people across different racial groups that are thought of as being people of color. So there was a kind of a natural sort of shifting and clustering together of excluded groups. And remember, as Li-Shin was saying, this is when in the 1880s, 1870s, 80s, this is when Reconstruction is failing, when the promises of the Civil War are disintegrating. African Americans are being, you know, sort of reconstrained and re-excluded within American society after a brief window of hope during the 1860s after the Civil War and the Civil War Civil Rights Amendments. So there is a lot of traffic going back and forth amongst people of color in this country who have a shared experience of marginalization.
Well, thank you again for calling in. Let's go next to Fran in San Francisco. Hi, Fran. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I have a comment. My exposure to the Chinese Exclusion Act is I've spent quite a bit of time transcribing ships' passenger lists on the lists of Chinese people who arrived after the Exclusion Act. And we all hear about what happened at Angel Island, but Angel Island wasn't in place around the turn of the century. And I'm aware of at least one man who arrived and was turned away, not turned away, but not allowed to enter the country. And they had no place to put him, so they put him in a crate on the pier.
Wow.
They had difficulty housing women who arrived and weren't accepted because they weren't willing to put them in jail. And the one thing that hasn't been mentioned was that there was was equal disarray when the Exclusion Act was enacted. There were many Chinese who were already on ships, and they were turned away when they got here.
Oh, it was complete. I mean, it's an enforcement nightmare, as May Nye, our historian, says. When you
they had already
when you put
left
in a place
China
restriction.
When the act was imposed, and with the understanding they would be able to land, but then the act occurred before they arrived, and they were turned away.
Boy, what does that remind you of?
Strangely
exactly
familiar today.
Yeah, very familiar
very
today.
Much.
And Li Xin, the other thing that we learn about in the film is the passage of the Page Act in 1875, mm-hmm. which prohibited immigration of people coming under contracts to work. It also prohibited prostitution. Chinese women who wanted to come to the United States had to prove that they were not prostitutes. And as the historians tell us in the film, a lot of women chose not to go through that humiliation. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's you know, you had to get permission on China's side with the U.S. consulate there. And it's, you know, if you imagine yourself going in and have to answer all these very, very personal detail about your life just to prove that you're not a prostitute, that you will never be one and never had been one. I mean, that just thinking about that gives me chills.
Yeah.
You know, the humiliation. So even though families may just did not want to put their wives, daughters into those positions, even though, you know, husbands may be over here and you're desperately wanting to join your family, but who wants to go through that? To them, be rejected? So it was a very deliberate move to allow no procreation of Chinese here so that gradually the community will just hopefully die out because if you can't have children, you know, what's next?
And Fran,
it was remarkably effective
go ahead,
as well.
Rick.
That the number, I mean, if you remember, this is a remarkably male society of Chinese immigrants in the mid-19th century. And the numbers before the Page Act of 1875, there were for every 1,000 Chinese men in the country, there were 78 Chinese women, which is already a remarkable distortion to be applying on a group in terms of family life, as Li Xin says, procreation. Female Chinese immigration just plummets after the Page Act of 1875, so that within 5 years, it's not 78 out of 1,000 are women. It's now 45 or something like that out of 1,000.
Wow.
And so it was extraordinarily effective at kind of like really, really closing off not just the female population but also the ability to create families and to therefore, you know, sort of generate families and generations of Chinese Americans.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you again for calling in and sharing that story, Fran. I hope you can see the film. Today, we are talking about the new documentary, The Chinese Exclusion Act, with co-directors Rick Burns and Li Xinyu. The film will have its West Coast premiere at the annual CamFest on Sunday at 7 o'clock at the Castro Theater in San Francisco. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's go next to Ruth Ann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruth Ann. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Good morning. I wanted to ask the guests if other grandparents came over from Ellis Island, and my dad was really reluctant and ashamed and never wanted to speak about it when we would ask all these questions. And the way I learned about my ancestry was through novels, you know, like great American novelists who wrote about immigration through Ellis Island to the Lower East Side. And I was wondering if that was comparable to other immigrant groups, if there was that sort of shame in not wanting to tell your kids what you went through when you came over.
Hmm. Thank you, Ruth Ann.
Well, yes. Angel Island, you know, some people say, well, it's the West Coast version of Ellis Island. But Ellis Island, really, if you look at the statistic, was a place that was much more welcoming. It was a gateway to America. Whereas Angel Island was established really as a guard post of not allowing, if possible, any Chinese to be admitted. And, you know, people were detained, you know, on average at least 2 weeks, 2 months. You know, the longest detention was 2 years. If you imagine what that must felt and meant, the being stuck on this island, being in a barrack situation, and just not knowing what your future will be. And so on the walls of the detention barrack in Angel Island, all the immigrants carved poems, just heartbreaking, beautiful poems about their experiences and their desires, their hopes, and their disappointment and disillusionment. It's really a remarkable place.
Rick, what are your thoughts? Did you find reluctancy among anyone you interviewed in sharing their experience?
You know, it's interesting that Ruth Ann, what you describe is so moving, which is this complicated relationship immigrants from anywhere have to the experience of immigration. And I think that my impression as a native-born American, not of Chinese ancestry, was that those experiences were exponentially greater for Chinese and then also Asian American immigrants. That there is particularly because the exclusion laws were a stigma. You know, you imagine you're the only group that it's not just that you're an immigrant and have that experience. You're an immigrant who's part of a group which has been stigmatized by national, federal law, and not just one law. You know, piece of legislation after piece of legislation down through the early 20th century, which is saying these people are unfit to be American. So already there's an enormous amount of complicated feeling surrounding this experience if you're Chinese American and later when it's extended to other Asian Americans. And also because there was a profound sense of the injustice of it. There was from the start a sense that we will not be excluded. And so you have the phenomenon well known at the end of the 19th century and into the 20th century of paper sons. What are paper sons? Paper sons are people who have come over illegitimately under fraudulent circumstances, having been created a sort of like a paper platform has been made for them to come by having it be made to seem that they are a child, a legitimate child of a Chinese American already in the country. And especially after the earthquake, San Francisco earthquake of 1906 destroyed all the records, it became increasingly possible, if still not, you know, always difficult, for people to come under this fraudulent means. Well, what does that mean? That means in an already stigmatized circumstance, you have family secrets that cannot be spoken of. People who you are, quote, related to, who live on the other side of Chinatown, but not really related to. You speak about them, but so there's this kind of family set of silences and shadows and things that are difficult to talk about, that are kind of known but not known. And that becomes then part of the experience of families for generations and generations, and that for people who, as Scott Wong, another one of our incredible historians, describes eloquently in the film, you know, there came a moment in the life of all Chinese sons and daughters of paper sons when it kind of becomes apparent that, right, that's why we don't really talk about great-grandpa. That's why grandfather is kind of reticent about his experience. So that silence that, you know, made you come to understand Ellis Island experience through novels was something that came down and sometimes hit with gale force power, you know, in midlife when suddenly the weight of the past kind of came down with particular impact for Chinese Americans, you know, of subsequent generations who had to live with that. And that's another aspect of exclusion. So it sort of permeates people's experience not just during the 62 years of exclusion, but continues to echo and, you know, have consequences and resonances down literally to today.
And we're almost out of time. I wish we had another hour, but I wanted to share a personal story with both of you. My great-grandmother was a Native American Pomo basket weaver from Ukiah. She was born in 1899.
Oh,
and she and my grandma used to always talk about the not being able to go in stores or restaurants because there were no Indians or dog signs in the windows. The only restaurant in Ukiah that allowed her family to eat and sit down was a Chinese restaurant. They had to sit behind the curtain, but the Chinese allowed them to come in and eat when no other restaurant would.
What a heroic, fantastic story.
Yeah.
We can all take courage from that.
Yeah. Really, yeah, really incredible. I wanted to ask you just quickly, we have about a minute left. Art says, what can we learn from the Chinese-American experience that can inform the way we react to the current actions by the Trump administration and his followers?
Okay, listen, you know, I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, so everybody will know I'm a dyed-in-the-wool hippie and progressive. But I'm also kind of an amateur student of history throughout much of my adult life. There has never been a time when immigration has been a problem in this country. Every time there has been exclusion, you know, Samuel Johnson said patriotism is the last refuge of scoundrels. I think in our own day, people who are sort of anti-immigrant, it becomes another refuge for ulterior motives. You really cannot make the case that the Chinese who came here were causing any trouble. In fact, it's very easy, from the labor force that built the Transcontinental Railroad to the 10,000 lawsuits that gave meaning and body to American rule of law, on and on and on, that these were people who were hardworking, who doubled down on the American dream, who believed more strongly than native-born Americans themselves in the American principles, and enlivened and enriched and made better the American experience. That's true whether you are Chinese American, Japanese American, Korean American, Mexican American, European American, from Africa, from South America. We have always benefited when our doors have been open. And when the doors begin to swing shut, you can almost take for granted that that's exactly the moment to say, what's really going on here? What's really at stake?
Rick Burns and Li Xin Yu are co-directors of the Chinese Exclusion Act. It'll screen at the CamFest on Sunday at 7 o'clock at the Castro Theater in San Francisco. Rick and Li Xin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rose, for having us.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.